And finally today, before we go, one last ode to Labor Day. The first Labor Day was celebrated in New York on September 5th, 1882. It was a time when families would get together at picnics and barbecues or go to sporting events, and we've asked some of our colleagues to tell us how they'll be spending their Labor Day.
I'm Sanaz Meshkinpour. I'm a member of the editorial staff on Tell Me More. This Labor Day weekend, I plan on laboring in the kitchen, experimenting with fish tacos, Korean short ribs, and bibimbap.
I'm Arjun Hutchins, one of the producers and one of the directors of Tell Me More. And this Labor Day, surprisingly, I will be laboring in my yard. As you know, recently Irene came through the D.C. metropolitan area, and I haven't cleaned up yet, so I'm going to have to do that at some point, and that day will be Labor Day.
Hi, I'm Alicia Montgomery, and I'm the senior editor here at Tell Me More. For this holiday weekend, I have lots of very, very exciting mommy plans. I've got play dates. I've got trips to Target. And most fun of all, new frontiers in toilet training my three-year-old son. So wish us luck.
I'm Amita Parashar, an editorial assistant here on Tell Me More, and I'm looking forward to sitting on a friend's porch in Charlottesville, Virginia, and eating some barbecue.
I'm Amy Ta, editorial assistant for Tell Me More. I normally don't celebrate Labor Day, so I guess I'll just be watching movies, reading, and definitely baking bread.
I'm Emily Oxenschlager, an assistant producer here at Tell Me More, and I can't think of a better way to spend Labor Day than spending a little time by the pool with a good book and then going out to get some Greek food with my mom for dinner.
I'm Malik Washington. I'm an editorial assistant here at Tell Me More, and I'm going back home to Pittsburgh to enjoy some quality time with friends and family over a bonfire and drinks.
My name is Iran Devar Ardalan, a senior producer at Tell Me More, and I'll be out on the grill cooking up some Persian chicken kebabs with saffron rice for family barbecue and making time to finally frame my wedding photos.
Hi, my name is Brian Jarbo. I'm the technical director for NPR's Tell Me More, and I plan on catching up on some much-needed sleep, playing a lot of music, and hopefully I'm going to make it up to the Maryland State Fair because that's always a lot of fun.
And that's our program for today. I'm Jackie Lydon, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We wish you a happy and restful Labor Day. Let's talk more tomorrow.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the new season of Dancing with the Stars premieres later this month with Chaz Bono as a contestant. Chaz began life as the daughter of Cher and Sonny Bono, and now he will be the first openly transgender person to compete on that top-rated show. We'll talk about what that means in just a minute. But first, it's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. Today, we want to talk about health and spirituality. Yesterday, we talked about how some women's attachment to their hairstyles may be keeping them out of the gym and how that might be contributing to the country's obesity crisis. Today in Faith Matters, we want to talk about how the traditional foods often served at church functions may also be aiding that crisis. In Mississippi, as in many parts of the country for that matter, attending church also means sharing food. And that can mean a lot of fried chicken, mac and cheese, pork chops, luscious pies, cobblers. You get the idea. Now, that may sound like heaven, but the problem is that Mississippi leads the nation in obesity rates. It's close to that ranking in diabetes and heart disease. For the last decade, Reverend Michael Miner has been trying to spread the gospel of healthy eating to his Mississippi congregation and others in the region. Initially, he ruffled feathers in his congregation by banning fried chicken from church events. But he's won converts among leaders of the National Baptist Convention. That group has invited him to develop health and wellness plans for its 10,000 member churches. And Reverend Miner joins us now to tell us how he did it. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Top of the day, Michelle.
So what inspired you to do this?
My members, when I first came to the Best Hill in DeSoto County, Oak Hill, I saw members that were of a special size. And I said, this special size is not going to work.
Do you have a background in nutrition or something like that? Or?
Oh, no. I'm just an old country boy from Coldwater, Mississippi that just love people. Nutrition was never top of my list. I used to be one of the worst people at eating. So, no, definitely don't have a background in that.
Did you have some sort of a health crisis or epiphany for yourself that caused you to change your own lifestyle?
Well, it was two things. I believe you got to be an example for your people. And then a few years ago, I had some health issues, not concerning necessarily being overweight, but it forced me to do better and also made me go to an overdrive because not only did I want my people, I have a desire for them to look better. I know how important it is to maintain your health. Look, Michelle, once you lose your health, it's hard to get it back.
One of the things, of course, that you are battling is that it's not just part of the, you know, regional heritage. It's also part of the cultural heritage of many people in the congregation, you know, and around the country, that there are certain foods that people kind of associate as their comfort foods, their traditional foods, and it's part of the heritage. And these recipes are handed down across generations, and people think it's not Sunday dinner without fried chicken. You know, you've talked about this in one of your sermons. I just want to play a short clip. Here it is.
Yeah, you said mama and grandmama did it, amen, but they were in the field too, wasn't it? And we eat up and go home and lay down. Amen, you look down like this and used to be you could see your feet. And now you see your belly button, come on. Hallelujah.
Do you find that humor is one way that you can help people accept the message?
It's the only way. I tried all the right ways of saying things. It's healthy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Look, I start telling pastors, if your congregation is not healthy, they can't tithe. They can't pay in your love day. And so I start sharing things like that, and I know it sounded crazy, but that's what actually started to work.
You're breaking it down to a very basic level. That
oh, that's
people...
right. You got to put it where people are.
What was the reaction initially? Because it's also very traditional that people will accord their pastors a lot of deference. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to listen to what you say. What was the reaction when you first started bringing this up? Did people just say, Pastor, you're crazy, or did they just not do it?
Basically, Pastor, you're crazy. Ban fried chicken? Something wrong with you. So, no, I had a lot of resistance. But the way that I was able to get it done, I showed them that you can actually save money by not eating fried chicken. Because there's something mysterious about fried chicken. When you look at it, you want to get all the pieces off the platter, and you just pick over it and only eat part of it. But now if you get grilled chicken or baked chicken, you'll just eat what you want. And overall then, you'll actually end up less chicken instead of more. But always remember, fried chicken has a mystique about it. It hypnotizes people, especially African Americans.
Well, I didn't know that, but thank you for unlocking that mystery for me. As we mentioned, that your gospel of healthy eating, that it is gaining traction, that you're getting other people to kind of see the wisdom of this. And our First Lady certainly has been trying to sound the word on this. And Oprah Winfrey, of course, the great, you know, media star, starting to sound the word on this. What do you think it is that's kind of getting people's attention?
Right. Well, for our denomination, it is part of our efforts to reach people where they are. Some of our national leaders came in and saw what we're doing there. And look, if you can start talking healthy in Mississippi, come on now. This is something that should be able to resonate across the country. Plus, you got to realize we got to work more on quality of life in America. We're living longer, but we're not enjoying our lives as we have in the past.
But what about this whole question, speaking of quality of life, one of the arguments that many people make about why it is that people, particularly of limited means, are suffering the most from obesity is that they don't have access to the best quality and the healthiest foods, that the less healthy foods are the ones that are subsidized, and that, you know, things like going to the gym and things like that are expensive. What do you say to people about that who say, look, Pastor, I can't afford to go into these fancy gym memberships, I can't afford a treadmill, and these fresh fruits and vegetables are just more expensive than ramen noodles and things like that that I use to make it through the month?
Two things. In the South, they talk about food deserts, but we have I-can't-cook deserts because even some of the people, if you put fresh fruits and vegetables, this newer generation just doesn't know how to or have the time, and we got to spend some time on working with them preparing foods. And the second thing, it starts young with the attitude of not exercising. We spoil our kids. We want them to do nothing. When I grew up, I did so much work before 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, If it were today, they probably would have arrested my grandfather for child abuse. We don't work our children. They don't get enough exercise. So I think if you look at those two things, those are more of a big issue than anything else.
And finally, before we let you go, do you think this whole question of sounding, you know, the gospel of better health, nutrition, and fitness, do you think that's becoming mainstream, or do you feel you have a way to go in getting people to accept that this is something that ministers should be talking about?
It's becoming mainstream. I mean, today I'm in Springfield, Missouri, here working with some United Methodists, of all things, to try to get some things done. I've gotten calls from across the country. People want to see this done, and we're getting back to the churches relevant and being relevant and engaging people where they are. You'll be hearing more about this.
Reverend Michael Meinhardt leads Oak Hill Missionary Baptist Church. That's in Hernando, Mississippi. What we caught up with him, as you just heard, in Jefferson City, Missouri, where he is traveling, and he joined us by phone from there. Reverend Meinhardt, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Michelle.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Laura Sullivan. Good Eats isn't your typical cooking show, and its host, Alton Brown, does a lot more than recite recipes. Quirky skits, puppets, and props all serve up the history and science of food. He likes to talk to the camera inside the refrigerator to explain where things come from, like, say, cream cheese.
When a New York dairyman named William Lawrence invented a spreadable mild cheese containing at least 33% milk fat and not more than 55% moisture, called cream cheese back in 1872, he had no idea that he was saving southern cake baking. But he was, because unlike butter, which melts at a relatively low temperature, cream cheese can hold its own shape until it reaches well above 250 degrees. That means that buttercream style frostings can be prepared and kept in hot summer months.
See how much you just learned? Alton Brown has a loyal horde of fans, and they're about to be very disappointed because Good Eats taped its final episode this week. Alton Brown is with me now from his offices in Atlanta. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Alton, how can you do this?
How can I do this? How can I shut it down?
Yes.
You know, it's been 13 years. It's one of those shows that to do it right is pretty much an all-consuming task. I've got so many other projects that I really want to do, and yet I'm not willing to let Good Eats slip down to even 95%. But I think that the new projects that I'm going to be doing are going to segue nicely. I'm not abandoning it. I'm just evolving.
You have taught people how to make macaroni and cheese without burning the cheese and the noodles, and you've also done even a diet program. I mean, how have you come up with all this stuff?
We've got a big sign over the door that says laughing brains are more absorbent. And one of the things that keeps us, you know, focused on is the fact that you've got to entertain first and foremost. You cannot teach without entertaining. And I've often said that I have the high school transcripts to prove that, because I barely got out of school alive because I wasn't entertained. So we've always thought that if we can entertain and tell good stories, be very visually arresting, then people will soak up the information. And we slather that information on very thick. We load it up.
Did you actually view it as a cooking show, or do you view it as a science show?
I don't know how I view it. You know, the whole thing came out of a memo to myself back in the 90s when I wrote down Julia Child, Monty Python, Mr. Wizard, and thought, if I could put those three things together, that would be fun.
Every episode that you've done has been so self-contained. It has its own sort of vision for the entirety of the episode. And you did one that was on waffles. It opens with you dressed up as a fictional superhero.
I'm the Waffler. I'm a crusader battling to save common, everyday, decent folk from the soul-stifling power of mediocre waffles.
Where did you come up with the idea for an episode to save the common folk from mediocre waffles?
Well, waffles are wonderful, and most people's expectations for waffles have gone really downhill. And any time that I see a good common food get lower and lower in quality, you know, you eventually have to stop and say, whoa, let's fix this. And so the waffle has certainly suffered.
You've earned a reputation over the years as sort of a mad scientist. And we have an example from an NPR segment you did back in 2002 on this show where you attached a blow dryer to a makeshift tin trash can to grill tuna.
That's heat. You know, what's interesting is not only are we creating more radiant energy by speeding the combustion of the charcoal, but we've created convection.
We may have just invented the first convection grill.
Where did that come from?
We call these hacks, and it's always come out of essentially being lazy and cheap. I want an end result, and I don't want to spend a bunch of money to get it, and I don't want to leave the house. So I go to the basement in the garage, and I find tools to do what it is I want to get done. And then you kind of back it up from there. You know, you MacGyver it.
You have this ability to bring things down to just the average person's level when it comes to food.
You know, I never think you have to bring anything down. People are not dumb. They are smart. And if you talk up, they'll come up. But you have to entertain them and you can't preach to them. That's where you lose them. But it's not a matter of making things accessible. I think everything's accessible. You just got to tell the story right.
That's Alton Brown. He just taped the final episode of his series Good Eats on the Food Network. His new cookbook, Good Eats 3, The Later Years, comes out this month. He's been speaking to us from his Atlanta office. Alton Brown, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me.